I didn't know I was supposed to hit the gavel, but I was. Welcome, everybody, to the 80th California Book Awards, as guided all these years by the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Mary Ellen Hannibal. It is my great pleasure to be the chair of the jury of the California Book Awards. And just to tell you a little bit about what that's all about, December to January, the Commonwealth Club starts to receive submissions to the California Book Awards from publishers. And the only qualification you need to have to submit your book to the California Book Awards is that you wrote it living in California. So this is really an interesting kind of slice of the literary world that we get to see. It's a huge one because, as you know, California is an enormous state and one of the most diverse states in the country. And I read that there will be no ethnic majority in California by the year 2040, which is not so far away. So the kinds of voices that we hear and are privy to through this literature that comes through here is an amazing kind of snapshot of the United States. It's different than what comes through New York, I think. We read a lot of books. The nonfiction selection comes from a group of about 130 books. So if you won those awards, you see what good job you did. The fiction award is also from about 90 submissions. First fiction is usually about 50. So it's really an enormous amount of writing that is going on in this state. In addition to where California is now and where we're going forward, we have an incredible literary tradition here. And past winners of this award include John Steinbeck, C.S. Forrester, Khaled Hosseini, Wallace Stegner, Michael Pollan, Michael Chabon, Amy Tan, William Vollman, and T.C. Boyle. So there's a number of people to thank. First of all, I'd like to thank a couple of people here at the Commonwealth Club who have really make this possible and just do Herculean work behind the scenes, especially Wendy Wanderman, and also a number of volunteers from the Commonwealth Club who really just did Herculean work to help really administrate the award. We have a jury that I would like to name. Many of them are here, and if you want to just sort of stand up or wave and say who you are, there's myself, Justin Chin, Dr. Martha Cox, who's up here on the dais, Catherine Gilmartin, Jewel Gomez, David Hellman, Kai Milner, Alden Mudge, Dean Rader, Grace Ruth, David Ulin, and Oscar Villalon. So the categories that you will be hearing from tonight are fiction, nonfiction, poetry, young adult literature, juvenile literature, first work of fiction, Californiana, and notable contribution to publishing. So I'll just say one more substantive thing, which is that every year sort of a strange and interesting pattern emerges in the winners. Nothing that drives the selection process, because it's only really after the books have been selected that you see the pattern. And this year I'll just ask you to listen to the winners talk about their books and see a couple of very interesting patterns of what kinds of books and what types of subjects crossing the boundaries of fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and everything else that won. We were very grateful to Bank of the West, our sponsor for this evening's award ceremony. And in addition to Bank of the West, would really love to acknowledge Martha Cox and the Ambassador Bill Lane, whose wife is here tonight in the audience over here. Thank you so much. We are very glad to have you here. And I think it bears just remarking that that Bill Lane and Mrs. Jean Lane also have funded and nurtured incredible Western and California initiatives that have helped define who we are, and helping who we know that we have been helps us figure out where we're going and who we want to be. So tonight, this Jack Boulware will be your host, and I will now hand the mic over to Mr. Richard Lewis, Executive Vice President for Bank of the West. Thanks.
Thank you, Mary, and Thanks to all of you for joining us this evening to honor California's authors. I'm truly appreciative of being here tonight. As a longtime supporter of the Commonwealth Club of California, Bank of the West is a proud sponsor. Is proud to sponsor the 80th California Book Awards this year. Bank of the West is committed to encouraging people to read and support authors like those who will be honored this evening. So in addition to sponsoring the California Book Awards tonight, we are also celebrating the culmination of a year-long partnership with the Raising a Reader organization this evening. With all the very advanced readers in the room today, I did want to add a personal note that pulls us way back. And I'm going to just give a quick story about my oldest son, Matthew. My oldest son, Matthew, struggled a great deal in the first and second grades in communicating with his teachers, developing good friendships, and with his schoolwork. My wife and I worked diligently with Matthew to get him more engaged in class. In the third grade, the turning point came. Matthew discovered his aptitude for reading. And my wife and I found the path to getting our son interested in his studies. Now in the fifth grade, Matthew reads above grade level and consumes all manner of books in as little as a day and a half. We often have to ask him not to bring his latest book to the dinner table. And I actually think that's a good thing, as opposed to not having to bring his PlayStation or whatever the course may be. But as my son's case demonstrates, and I know that we take reading for granted all within this room, reading provides a path to young minds, and I'm sure I don't have to tell you this, to discover the world, to developing critical thinking skills, and ultimately the road to creativity and invention. Raising a Reader's mission is to engage parents in a routine of daily book cuddling with their children from birth to age five to foster healthy brain development, parent-child bonding, and early literacy skills critical for school success. With that, I'd like to introduce the Executive Director of Raising a Reader, Gabrielle Miller.
Thank you, Richard. Good evening, everyone. I am absolutely delighted to have the opportunity to represent Raising a Reader here this evening. It's such a wonderful, wonderful event. As Richard said, Raising a Reader helps families develop, practice, and sustain the habit of reading together through something that we call book cuddling. The data, including brain science, show very, very clearly that this simple habit has incredible effects on language and cognitive development. And for many children of varying degrees, it can have an incredible impact on their lives. Last year, Raising a Reader helped 110,000 families across the country develop literacy habits in their home. 42,000 of those families are here in California. So we're very, very proud of that. And needless to say, once we develop this habit, it's important to sustain that habit and maintain the habit. And the way that we do that is that we help children make strong connections to libraries. So during our program, children each week take home a little red bag with books in it. Then at the end of the program, they get a blue bag where they get to keep and that they use at the libraries. And we had a very special partner this year in helping us build our connections to libraries, and that is the Bank of the West. Children in communities where Bank of the West employees live and work received resources and encouragement to continue to borrow books and book cuddle. And instead of borrowing books from school, they borrowed books from the library. And I have to take a minute and show you the bag that Bank of the West sponsored this year. I'll hold it up so you can see it, but this is what it looks like on the front. It has our logo, and normally there's nothing on the back. And then on the back, the Bank of the West bags, you see the iconic bear, and the bear is reading a book, and we're just absolutely delighted. There were events all over the country celebrating these bags. The information I had when I wrote my notes was that 1,100 bags were distributed. In fact, it was 1,600. We found out there were 500 more today. So I can't tell you how delighted we were. And they not only gave out these bags. Inside the bag was a book for children to keep. And this book, called Three Cups, gave children a developmentally appropriate way to understand money and saving money and what you can do with giving money and how you can help other people with money. So it was just absolutely lovely, and I cannot tell you how much it meant to the children and families we serve. Bank of the West employees did an incredible job. From the senior executives on down, I was at an event with one of your senior executives who sat on the floor with children reading books, and he was just absolutely delightful. But their enthusiasm is as important as the books and the bags, and we can't thank them enough. We know that when children have the opportunity to experience reading as more than just something they do at school, they become lifelong readers. They come to understand that, in the words of Rudeen Sims Bishop, that books are both windows and mirrors, windows through which children can see other worlds and mirrors in which they can see themselves in those pages. We know they need the windows and the mirrors to broaden their experience of life. So, on behalf of Raising a Reader's National Office, all of our affiliates, all of our parents, all of our families, thank you to Bank of the West for your tremendous support in partnering with us this year, and our very sincere congratulations to all of the winners. Those readers in the room, we appreciate the windows and the mirrors that you've given us through your works. So thank you very, very much.
I'm hoping there's an aspect of Gabrielle's work that will head off the next credit crisis. Thank you, Gabrielle, for all that you do for children and families in our communities and for joining us here this evening. Before we begin, I'd like to offer my introduction to Jack Bulwar, author and founder of Litquake and our MC for this evening. Thank you very much.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jack. Thank you all for coming. And thank all of you for continuing to read books and to support authors. I'm not on the poster. Don't bother looking. I am in the program, though. I was just asked tonight on the street if I could MC. Richard and Wendy were hissing at people. I had a necktie, so here I am. I didn't actually know that you needed to, as an author, submit to be considered eligible for the California Book Award, so I kind of feel like an ass. I had a book that came out in 2009, and I had no idea that, you know. So all of you authors out there who have not submitted your book to be eligible, you could MC at some point. I just want you to know. That might happen. Okay, let's move right along. We begin tonight with juvenile literature. That's for young people. The finalists are, and by the way, the finalists may or may not be here tonight, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't go out and patronize their work and buy their books as well. So the finalists for juvenile literature are Beverly Gehrman for Sparky, The Life and Art of Charles Schulz. Renee Cotto Lainez for From North to South, Del Norte al Sur. Barbara Curley for The Extraordinary Mark Twain, According to Susie. And Icy Smith for Half Spoon of Rice, A Survival Story of the Cambodian Genocide. So our first winner tonight is a self-confessed sci-fi geek who wrote her first story at the age of 5. Last August, she published this charming story about the love of gardening shared by a young girl and her grandmother. After grandma dies, the girl remembers details of their time together and hopes to teach her mother what she has learned so they can then create a garden together. The gold medal winner in juvenile literature for Grandma's Gloves goes to Cecil Castellucci. Please. Or is it Cecil? Oh, okay.
I don't know if you'll be able to see me. I'm going to take it off. All right. So in 1996, I moved to Los Angeles, and I was in love with the fact that my garden bloomed during Christmas time. And in 1999, my grandmother died. And a week later, I dreamt that I wrote a book about her and her love of plants. Because, you know, gardens are about life and death and then life again. But she lived in Quebec City, so she didn't really have a garden. But she had a very green thumb. So obviously this book is Grandma's Gloves. Liz Bicknell at Candlewick Press almost bought the book in 2001, but she rejected it, and then she rejected three other books after that until she realized she was not the right editor for me, and she passed me along to Kara LaRoe at Candlewick Press, who bought my first two novels and then came back around to Grandma's Gloves. She bought Grandma's Gloves, and then she left Candlewick. And I was passed along to the fabulous editor, Deb Wayshack, who worked on the book with me and hired Julia Denos to draw the pictures, which are extraordinary. But Candlewick is based in Boston, and Julia lives in Boston. And so there was a big conversation about, oh, this book should take place in Boston. And but I'm a girl who loves my garden that blooms in Christmas time. So I went out, and I took a million pictures of my neighborhood during Christmas time and all the flowers that were blooming, and they agreed that maybe it should be in California. And I think that Julia did a beautiful, beautiful job. But the point is that this book took 11 years to come out, but it's really the book that started my career. And my career started in California. So this award means a lot to me because it's the California Book Award. So thank you so much to the Commonwealth Club of California, and congratulations to all the other authors. Thank you.
Oh, Cecil.
Come right over here on the other side.
In front.
Okay.
Oh, in front?
Yeah.
Where do I go? I don't know. They didn't tell me what to do.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's go right around
go
here.
Around.
Oh.
Sorry.
Is this being televised?
Thank you.
Beautiful. Cecil Castellucci. It's a nice loose feel to the whole show, isn't it? Our next award is for young adult literature. That's for young adults. The finalists are Margarita Engel for The Firefly Letters, A Suffragette's Journey to Cuba, Ron Kurtke for Shakespeare Makes the Playoffs, and Neil Schusterman for Bruiser. This category's winner fell in love with reading as a young adult, and now she writes for this same audience. Her pitch-perfect novel is about the consequences of war. A soldier returns home after spending 3 years fighting in an unspecified desert country. Although he has been declared healthy by the U.S. Marines, his brother thinks otherwise. The changes in behavior become apparent. The soldier rarely speaks or leaves his room. The radio is tuned to static all night long. When he finally decides to leave the house and announces he is going to walk the Appalachian Trail, his brother decides to follow him. For her book, The Things a Brother Knows, we give the gold medal in young adult literature to Dana Reinhardt.
I think as the audience for the books gets older, we might get a little taller, too, each. You might be able to see me a little better than Cecil, but only a little bit. I left a camping trip with my two young daughters. It's their end of the year all school camping trip that's down in Pescadero. And my 6-year-old was going to sing tonight in the talent show, and I'm missing this tonight. I'm going to tell you this for two reasons. One is that there's almost nothing in the world that would keep me from watching my brave 6-year-old girl get up in front of an auditorium full of people and sing an Ingrid Michaelson song, except for maybe the incredible honor of winning this award. So I left for that. But the other reason, there's another reason I'm telling you this. The other reason is that I had to, you know, explain to all the other parents why I was leaving before my daughter was going to do this show, because they were looking at me like there was something wrong with me. And I heard myself throughout the day say, well, you know, my book is getting an award, so I have to go. You know, my book is getting an award. And then I suddenly stopped and I thought, you know, I'm a writer and I'm really particular about words and language. And why am I saying my book is getting an award? Because if my book was getting the award, it could drive up here from Pescadero, and I could stay and watch the talent show. And then I thought again, and I thought, you know what? It is the book that's getting the award. It really isn't me, because there are so many different hands that go into making a book successful. And I want to thank a lot of those hands, that from friends who read early drafts and tell you what's working and what isn't, for the hard, incredible hard work, sometimes meanness of my editor, who makes me go back over and over again, from all the people at Random House who turned it into a beautiful object. With this book particularly, I have to thank sort of the countless people whose stories I read and listened to on NPR or watched in documentaries about what it is like to come home from war and how hard that is for them, how hard it is for their families. All of those stories, you know, inspired me to write this book. All of the librarians and booksellers and teachers who worked tirelessly to get small books into the hands of readers. And finally, to young readers themselves, who I think are underestimated sometimes in by a lot of us and what they are capable of and what they can relate to. And just today I got an email, I just wanted to quote to finish up here, that from a kid who I did a school visit recently. She wrote me this incredibly beautiful email, and it said, "Thank you so much. After you came, I read your book, and I had no idea. I'd never really thought about soldiers coming home and what I just assumed if they came home, they'd be happy to be home and everything would be fine. And I never took the time to think about how hard their lives could be afterwards. So thank you for that." And I also, she said, I was really happy to meet you because I did, when I met you, I realized authors were just real people. And I guess I thought maybe you'd dress better. So that was funny. Anyway, thanks. I tried to dress up to do her proud. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club. Thank you to all the judges who read all the books. And congratulations to everybody. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Dana. Our next award is for contribution to publishing, which honors a California-based publishing house for its contribution to the literary landscape. An author who makes bestseller lists 100 years after death is a member of a very small club. The autobiography of Mark Twain is the fruit of an extraordinary collaboration between humanities scholars of the Mark Twain Project and the University of California Press. This volume, the first of three, presents for the first time the uncensored Twain speaking his whole frank mind in the form and style he intended. The Lickwake Festival actually helped launch this book last November, and it is truly a fantastic achievement. So we give the gold medal in contribution to publishing to the University of California Press for the autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1, edited by Harriet E. Smith and other editors of the Mark Twain Project. Accepting the award will be lead editor Harriet E. Smith and associate editor Benjamin Griffin.
First of all, let me acknowledge my colleague who is here, but not up here, which is Ben, my co-editor. I telegraphed orders to have the proofreader shot without giving him time to pray. That is a typical remark of Mark Twain's about editors and proofreaders, who offered uninvited emendations of his work. There was one occasion when he invited a friend to edit an essay he had written about Joan of Arc. He asked him to cut out all the lies and purify the grammar. But when he saw the results, he was, not surprisingly, appalled. His straightforward, clear prose had been altered to become fancy words, clichés, and stilted expressions. So he drafted a letter to his friend, which he didn't send, actually, but is in the first volume of the autobiography. And he said to him, "I believe you innocently meant well. Your lack of literary judgment, literary talent, literary perception, with a small knowledge of grammar and the meaning of words are to blame, not you." And he ended with this advice: you ought never to edit except when awake. The editors at the Mark Twain Project are of an entirely different sort from the kind that Mark Twain was so annoyed by. Our task is to produce a text that is faithful to the author's intentions, and that reflects his wishes in every way. As Jack told you, this is the first complete edition of the text, with no omissions, excisions, rewritings, and so forth. I don't know if Mark Twain would have approved of our effort, but I'm sure he would have been extremely gratified at its reception. It became a bestseller, the focus of international media attention, and in fact, there are in the works plans to translate it into 9 languages, including Croatian and Turkish. He is truly the most popular American author, and it is he who is responsible for the success of this book. Our contribution is secondary, but I want to thank the jury for recognizing our part in bringing this very important work, his last major literary work, to print. Thank you.
Thank you, Harriet. Our next award is the Californiana. I'm sorry, I sound like California. He's in the news for something very different these days. Anyway, this award honors the writer who best discusses an aspect of the Golden State. We take a hike on Mount Tam. We bring visitors to Alcatraz. We may think we know California. The winner of this award corrects our vision, or rather, enlarges it. Through beautiful paintings, the author recreates the California of the past, including long-banished denizens like the grizzly bear. The text carefully reconstructs the landscape's natural history, and the illustrations ask us to imagine what a restored Golden State might look like. For her book, A State of Change, Forgotten Landscapes of California, we give the gold medal for Californiana to Laura Cunningham. Unfortunately, Laura is unable to attend tonight. The California landscape has actually reclaimed her. She was stuck in a snowstorm yesterday on the passes of the Sierra Nevada. So accepting her award tonight will be Malcolm Margolin from Heyday Books.
Yeah, thank you. No, thank you. You know, listening to Mark Twain's wonderful comments on editors makes me remember my favorite comment, my favorite definition of an editor is somebody who separates the wheat from the chaff and throws out the wheat. Despite our editorial efforts, Laura came out with a wonderful book. She'd been working on it for 30 years. This was not a drive-by shooting. This was not one of these instant successes. This was something of deep passion. The wonderful thing about being able to accept this award is I can talk about what a wonderful book it is, which Laura would have difficulty doing. And it has a sense of yearning for an old California, a sense of scholarship, a sense of beauty. She approaches the past with a kind of diffidence, a kind of respect for the unknowability of the past. She treads lightly on it. She looks at it with wondering eyes. She looks at it with the eyes of an artist and with the eyes of a scientist. It was a pleasure to publish it, and I think there's something in this imagining of the past that allows, if we can imagine a beautiful past, we can imagine a beautiful future. And I hope that this book leads to that beautiful future. And I really thank the Commonwealth Club for this award. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Malcolm. Our next award is poetry. This year's submissions were so strong, we decided to bestow an additional silver medal in this category. So tonight we'll be awarding 2 outstanding works of poetry. The finalists are Julie Halebski for Sky Equals Empty, Barbara Jane Rees for Diwata, and Brian Turner for Phantom Noise. Tonight's silver medal winner traces the excruciating experiences of six African Americans during the 19th century. This riveting collection breaks bold new ground for the project of historical poetry, depicting a world of fugitive slaves, free people of color, and kidnapped northern-born blacks as they attempt to navigate the rural and urban settings of Virginia and Philadelphia. In language both accessible and innovative, this author makes these often overlooked scenarios come alive. For her collection, Suck on the Marrow, the silver medal in poetry goes to Camille T. Dungy. Am I pronouncing that right?
No.
Dungy, thank you. She is unable to attend tonight, and so accepting the award on her behalf will be her husband. Please welcome Ray Black.
We do get taller, right? Camille very much wishes she could be here to accept this award in person. She's deeply honored and touched to be recognized among such elite company as she sends, and she sends her gratitude. She sent me a script. I'm going to go off script for a second because she, in addition to being very honored by your award and to be recognized as a Californian, she was writing this book when she came back to California after several years in Virginia, and that's when we met. And as she's writing this book, and I'm researching a dissertation on 19th century African American literature, and she's writing a book of poetry on 19th century African Americans, it's a very special to both of us that you're honoring us now. That we're here, and our daughter, who's a year old next week, is born in San Francisco. So this is a special connection for us. Back to the script. Unfortunately, Camille is in Iowa right now, where this morning she attended the funeral of her 92-year-old grandmother, Dr. Callie Madge Thornton, and our daughter is named Callie Violet after this grandmother. As she thought about what to have me say, me as in her husband, to you, she remembered a dream she had when her grandmother descended into what would be her final illness. In the dream, the grandmother said, "Remember these stories." Camille said, "I will, grandmother." Her grandmother then said, "Write them down." And Camille said, "I will." That's the charge Camille lived with while writing Suck on the Marrow. And she did. It was. She's remembered these stories. She's written them down. She's imagined the complex lives of those who lived before us so they will not be forgotten, dismissed, or denied. Camille is very honored to be recognized by the Commonwealth Club and the California Book Awards as a true California author, and saying as those the rare chance that the author's supporters and partners who stand by them while they're battling with editors about titles such as Suck on the Marrow and book covers and book lengths and why do you have a glossary in the back of a book of poetry. And you may, as editors and readers, see the final result or the in progress. We who live with you wonderful authors get to hear what they would otherwise say uncensored, and support and hold hands and have the tissues. But it is really an honor. We are honored, and those of us who love her and support her, thank you from the bottom of our heart. I thank you for her for this award. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ray. For the Gold Medal Award in Poetry, no book in the wide atlas of contemporary poetry is quite like this winner of the Lexi Rudnitsky Prize. I Googled it. It exists. It is a very prestigious prize. The author uses cartography as a guiding principle to map the ways geographical landscapes encroach onto our emotional landscapes and vice versa. This book guides us through familiar but dangerous territories, memories, language, divorce, family, death, loss, and language yet again. The only thing better than finding these maps is getting lost in them. For the book Mortal Geography, we give the gold medal in poetry to Alexandra Teague.
I'm really so honored and still amazed to be receiving this award, particularly with all the really other wonderful books that were up this year. And I keep joking with friends that the key to winning is to spend 14 years working on your first book. So I know I've been beaten by a couple of people here who spent 30 on theirs, but I did spend 14 years on this. I didn't set out to do that. I started teaching composition full-time right out of graduate school, and for many years I was just writing a poem at a time as I had the time to do that. I wasn't thinking that I was writing a book. In retrospect, I'm really glad that the book evolved this way because it includes all kinds of experiences and stories and landscapes I couldn't have anticipated when I began it, including California and poems about riding San Francisco buses and other things that I didn't even know about when I wrote the earliest poems back in Missouri years ago. The book also includes poems about my mother's death, which happened about 10 years ago, several moves across the country, and a lot of stories that my colleagues and students have been generous enough to share with me teaching at City College of San Francisco for most of the past decade. And I even ended up writing some poems about teaching grammar, which was not something I ever anticipated, but which builds on my lifelong love of language and fascination with its limitations and capabilities. And I really want to thank my colleagues and students at City College, my students who love poetry and the ones who profess to hate it, because that was always good for me to think about this strange thing I was doing and how I could make it better connect to my life and the life of other people. And teaching is continuously humbling, and I really learn every day from my students. And I also really want to thank the Stanford University and the Stegner Fellowship, which I had from 2006 to 2008. Without that time and the wonderful feedback I got there, the book would still be just poems in various journals and in my drawers. And I got amazing feedback from all the faculty in the Stegner Fellowship and from the other fellows, and I'm continuing to learn from all of them. And I also really benefited from being in a community of people who believe that poetry mattered, even if it's in small ways, for our humanity and for enlarging the language available to us. And I'd also like to thank some of my earlier teachers, Michael Burns at Southwest Missouri State and William Logan at University of Florida, who I'm still learning from. And my family, I was really fortunate to be raised by a father who was a journalist and a mother who was quite a storyteller. So I came to a love of narrative naturally. And my poems are, by a lot of poetry standards, quite narrative still. And I know people have been talking about horror stories with editors, but Gabriel Fried at Persia Books has been absolutely amazing. And he was the first person who really believed in this as a book. And they've been a wonderful press to work with. And Lexi Rudnitsky, for whom the first book prize is named, was a wonderful poet who died when she was about my age, and the prize was established in her honor. And so it's a sad but great honor to be in her legacy. I'll close with something that one of my all-time favorite poets, Larry Levis, said about first starting to write poetry. He was 16 years old, and he'd been reading Eliot and Frost and Stevens. And he says, "I decided one night to try to write a poem. When I was finished, I turned out the light. I told myself that if the poem had one good line in it, I would try to be a poet. And then I thought, no, you can't say try. You will either be a poet and become a better and better one, or you will not be a poet. The next morning I woke and looked at what I'd written. It was awful. I knew it was awful. But it had one good line. One. All the important decisions in my life were made in that moment." And I can't say that I had the same kind of decisive moment of becoming a poet, but I can very much relate to just trying to get one good line or sometimes one good word. And it's a process that keeps challenging and inspiring me. So I'm so grateful to the Commonwealth Club and to the poetry panel for thinking that I guess there are some good lines in this book. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexandra. We now move on to First Fiction, a very important award which honors a writer for a strong first effort in the fiction category. The finalists are Angie Chow for Quiet as They Come, Tim T. Hernandez for Breathing in Dust, and Suzanne Rivecca for Death is Not an Option. Tonight's winner is a computer scientist and first-time author who offers a compelling meditation on the question, how does our vision of the classics change throughout the ages? Imagining alternative scenarios and hidden stories within Homer's Odyssey, the author challenges our assumptions about the continuity of classic narratives. The pieces of this story may be experimental, but the language is not. It's clear, spare, and beautiful, with timeless intonations that echo Homer's prose. Both a love letter to the classic story and a nod to our fragmented future ones, this book is at once powerful, ambitious, and delightful. For The Lost Books of the Odyssey, a novel, the gold medal and first work of fiction goes to Zachary Mason.
So first I'd like to thank my agent, Bill Clegg, who found me wandering in the wilderness about 2 years ago, and also my editor, John Galassi, who was a dream. So since I wrote a book that rewrites and reinterprets Homer, I'm often asked if I think there was, in fact, a historical Homer. And consulting the literature is of little value on this question insofar as there are serious people who are passionately committed to every possible position on it. So my answer is it doesn't matter that whether or not there was a Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey were oral traditions. And as such, they were very slightly rewritten by every singer who sang them and each time they were sung. So as such, they are collaborative works. And more than that, they were told so many times and over such a long time that it seems like they would have evolved into a sort of platonic work. Each singer would have seen what worked with which audiences, and so perhaps the works would have approached the perfection that we have today. And if the Iliad and the Odyssey are in fact sort of inhumanly perfect books, then that justifies to some extent my hubris in rewriting them. So when I set out to write this book, I had two things in mind. One was something that Borges said to the effect that he had never written a novel because in a novel there's always something to excess. So I wanted to write a book with nothing in excess. There was also the idea, well, I didn't really expect to get published, as that seemed like an unthinkably remote goal. But what I was trying to do was write a book such that if I'd had nothing to do with it, but found it in a used bookstore, I would have liked it. Unfortunately, I've had enough to do with it that I, you know, could probably recite it from memory. So I don't really know what I would think if I found it and hadn't written it. But I hope in about 40 years that I'll have forgotten enough of it for this to be practical. Thank you.
Thank you, Zachary. And now it's time to award the medals for nonfiction. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll were not invented in one test tube. But if they were, Timothy Leary would have been the funmeister shaking the ingredients. The merry trickster and LSD proselyte gets highly personable treatment in this seismic story, wherein the staid 1950s are cracked open to reveal a new generation of fellow spiritual leaders, including Ram Dass, Andrew Weil, and Houston Smith. For his book, The Harvard Psychedelic Club, we award the silver medal to Don Latin.
Thank you, Jack. First, I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club for this award. I'm very honored and thrilled to receive it. You know, I've only lived in California the last, 47 years of my life. My wife is a fourth-generation Californian, so 47 years puts me one rung above a tourist in her eyes. But I'm hoping this will do something to redeem myself. I also feel very honored to win this award. I felt very honored when I looked over the list of past winners of the Silver Award in nonfiction, which included Wallace Stegner, Fawn Brody, Will Durant, Will Saroyan, not to mention a couple of my dearly departed friends and colleagues from the San Francisco Chronicle, where I spent many years working as the religion writer. One of them was Randy Schultz, who wrote, and the band played on, about the AIDS crisis. He was really the first kind of gay beat writer on a paper in the country. And my very good friend, Alan Tempko, a Pulitzer Prize winner, who was the architecture critic at the Chronicle. And I just can't imagine Alan ever writing a book, because even though he was a journalist for Daily Newspaper, we used to say he had writer's block the size of the Parthenon. But somehow he managed to write an award-winning book. So I feel really touched to be in that company. I also wanted to thank Mark Tauber, who is the publisher at Harper One here in San Francisco. He saw the potential in this book and actually asked me to write it. And so as you may guess, it's not a very hard sell when the publisher has the idea for your book. But I really had a blast writing it. Now, while the story of the Harvard Psychedelic Club begins on the East Coast in Harvard, the action soon moves out to California for the buildup of the 1967 Summer of Love, which some of you less enlightened among you may remember as a Summer of Lust. But either way, the summer has taken on mythological dimensions in both local and national consciousness. In fact, Scoop Nisker was on the radio yesterday. Scoop was an old radio guy from KSAN back in the days in the 60s and early 70s. He was talking about the importance of the 60s, and he suggested that that America should install a monument to the unknown hippie on the National Mall. And I like that idea, and I second that motion. As I say in the Harvard Psychedelic Club, the four men profiled in my book, Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil, really forever changed the way, or helped to change the way, Americans view religion and practice medicine, the very way we look at body and soul. And you know, I wasn't here for the Summer of Love. I arrived a few years later and tried to keep the party going as long as I could, perhaps a little too long. Actually, that's what I'm writing about in my next book, which is another group biography, but also part memoir. I'm writing about my many years as a religion reporter for a major metropolitan newspaper, and also some less distinguished activities that I was involved with over the decades. So stay tuned for that one. And last, I just wanted to confess that, like many people in this town, I'm a born-again fan of the San Francisco Giants. And perhaps some of you have noticed, this just shows how the vision of the 60s has permeated our culture. Some of the ads for the Giants, both on KNBR and on TV, some of the, like two or three of them reference the 60s. One of them talks about hovering over the White Rabbit. The Jefferson Airplane song is playing in the background. They're talking about hovering over the ballpark. And they even appropriated the infamous words of Timothy Leary when they say, tune on, tune in, repeat. So hopefully we can do that. And again, thank you very much for this award.
Thank you, Don. And go Giants. We move on to the gold medal in nonfiction. After discovering the cultural icon Charlie Chan at an estate sale, this author became an avid fan. But Chan's role as the honorable detective from Hollywood movies is more than simply a relic from politically insensitive times. This scholar weaves together histories of the real-life detective upon whom Chan was based, the novelist who originally created the character, the dramatic upheaval of Hawaii and China, and the author's own personal history. In excavating the character of Charlie Chan, this writer finds a bridge for himself and for us between China and the U.S., the past and the present, fiction and reality. For Charlie Chan, the untold story of the honorable detective and his rendezvous with American history, the gold medal in nonfiction goes to Yuntae Wang.
Thank you so much. At this moment, I was not thinking, what would Jesus say? But what would Charlie Chan say, really? I was planning to take a bite of the gold medal to see if it's real gold, and then I realized it's really such a foolish thing to do. I should have, you know, I felt that whatever is good enough for John Steinbeck should have been more than good enough for me. So thank you so much. I feel such a great honor. And I'm also particularly happy to follow up on the Harvard Psychedelic Club book, because 8 years ago, and I was offered a job at UC Santa Barbara, where I'm currently teaching, and I was planning to leave Harvard, my first job there. And I was sitting on the beach. I first saw the city, and then I took a walk on State Street in Santa Barbara, and then realized, you know, wow, actually, I could move out here and become a writer, and which is what I did. And what a foolish mistake it was, I soon realized that I spent 2 years sitting on the beach looking at absolutely mesmerizingly beautiful place, but I just had a writer's block as big as any block you can encounter. So I was stuck for 2 years not being able to write anything until one day I slowly kind of picked up on reading of Raymond Chandler, Ross McDonald, Sue Grafton, and Dasher Hammett, all these great California mystery writers. And then slowly I realized nowadays when I started driving around, when I saw the big multi-million-dollar mansions in Montecito or Pasadena, I can see dead bodies behind them. And then I felt much better about the world and about California. And I thought, now, you know, those are not just places I cannot afford, but actually these are human spaces as well. So it was really California and the genre of mystery writing that got me hooked and, you know, and got me to write on this Chinese detective. So thank you so much. And thanks to the Commonwealth Club and the judges. Thank you.
Thank you, Yunte. It's time now to award the medals for fiction. The finalists are Zoe Ferraris for City of Veils, Joan Frank for In Envy Country Stories, and Adrienne Sharp for The True Memoirs of Little Kay. Tonight's silver medal winner wanted to be a poet, but instead has become a fiction writer. In this darkly comic novel, the author presents us a window into the underside of the American dream, told through the lives of an idyllic family fractured by the combination of real estate failure and a catastrophic accident, and a forced move to the high desert isolation of Southern California. Told with compassion and humor and unflinching honesty, this is a perfect novel for our time. For his novel, Model Home, we award the Silver Medal in Fiction to Eric Puchner.
Thank you so much. This is such an honor for me. So that's what happens to failed poets. They become fiction writers, apparently. The last time I was here at the Commonwealth Club, my wife was actually being honored up here. She's a novelist, Catherine Noel. And so I just want to thank the Commonwealth Club for restoring the balance in our marriage. This is really such an honor to me to get this award, because the book is all about California, and I've lived here off and on since I was 12. You know, California really inspired the book in so many different ways. This book came out of a couple different incidents. I mean, the genesis of the book came out of a couple of different incidents. One was just an anecdote I heard, which was that a friend of mine told me a story about his wife, who used to live on a block in New Mexico, and her neighbor came home from vacation one day and got out of the car and was walking to his house, and he lit a cigarette and his house exploded. And he caught on fire, and my friend's wife was the one who actually ran out with a blanket and put him out. He had left the stove on for the whole weekend. And just that image, I couldn't get that image out of my head for years. I was thinking about that image and what it says about the precariousness of home and of our lives. And so I decided to write a comic novel about it. The other thing that happened is that I went to on a trip to Antelope Valley down in L.A. in the Mojave Desert, and I was driving around, and I saw all of these gated communities in the middle of nowhere, these bedroom communities, these subdivisions that are 2 hours outside of L.A., and the people were actually commuting into L.A. from these communities, and they were going belly up. I mean, they were getting boarded up, and no one was living there. And I just kept thinking about that image as well. So I came up with a family who are downwardly mobile and end up living out in the desert in one of these communities. In fact, it's the father's community. He's a real estate developer, and they end up living in one of his out in the middle of the Mojave Desert. So that's the book, and I just wanted to thank everybody who was involved in seeing this book to fruition, a couple of whom are here, two of my good friends, Andrew Altrell and Scott Hutchins, who read this book, I think, in several different drafts. I can't thank you enough. The book was originally over 800 pages, so they put a lot of time and effort into this book, and I thank them. I thank them deeply, and I thank the Commonwealth Club once again. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Eric. And finally, our gold medal for fiction. This ambitious, inventive, and sweeping novel tells the story of a group of students, artists, professors, farm workers, and revolutionaries devoted to social change from 1968 to the mid-70s, converging eventually at San Francisco's International Hotel. Divided into 10 novellas of overlapping tales, this book captures the pivotal public events of an era and the emergence of a community that would start to collectively identify itself as Asian American. For her novel, I, Hotel, the gold medal in fiction goes to Karen Te Yamashita.
To thank you, the members of the Commonwealth Club, and also the judges for the California Book Award. I am deeply honored. Thank you so much. I was born in Oakland, California, and I was raised in Los Angeles. I am a product of California's public education, and I remember my teachers, and I want to remember them tonight as some of the most dedicated intellectuals whose teaching changed my life. In particular, I want to mention and thank my English teachers, Virginia Buchanan and Lelia Casey Krejci, whose instruction and wisdom were truly gifts. They were the gifts of education and my future, given not only to me, but to so many other students as well. And now I have the privilege of teaching at the University of California at Santa Cruz. It's truly a miracle that I'm there. And I implore you as citizens of California to keep alive the dream of equal opportunity and public education for our students. My grandparents immigrated to California at the turn of the last century, 1900. And my parents and most of their siblings graduated from Cal Berkeley. They were immigrant families of modest means, but they got an education at Cal. And they always showed deep appreciation for that opportunity. But in 1942, with World War II, my parents and their families were forced to leave California for the desert terrain of a concentration camp in Topaz, Utah. At the end of the war, our families returned to California to start life over again. And by the 1960s, they'd spawned another generation in a time of great turmoil and political change. In 1968, I was about to graduate high school, and that was the year of the new year. In the new year began with the Tet in Vietnam, and a historic turn in that war that made it clear that technology and arrogance could not win a war. And then by the end of the year, Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy were assassinated, and riots broke out all over in major cities in this country. The country saw the Chicago police beat up demonstrators at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, and students at San Francisco State College and University of California, Berkeley, closed down both institutions to protest and rally for a third world college and ethnic studies, to hire faculty of color, to eliminate the barriers of class and race, and to give access to higher education to African American, Latino American, African American, and Asian American students. And so begins the story of the I Hotel in 1968, from 1968 to 1977, here in the San Francisco Bay Area, with its center at the I Hotel, or the International Hotel, on Kearney and Jackson Street between North Beach and Chinatown, the old center of the Filipino-American community. The I Hotel was built back in the 1900s, and by the 1970s had become the home of elderly Filipino and Chinese bachelors who had worked as migrant laborers, longshoremen, fishermen, veterans of war, factory laborers, merchant mariners, cooks, and laundrymen. Laws of restrictive immigration, miscegenation, and wars prevented them from family and married lives. And after a lifetime of work, these men refused to be evicted from the I Hotel to be replaced by a parking lot and corporate greed. They were supported by students and community activists and thousands of supporters in the city of San Francisco and its Bay Areas, all of whom struggled to prevent the eviction and demolition of the hotel for 10 years. On a night in August 1977, over 5,000 people surrounded the hotel in 12 rows of their bodies and changed the way we think about the dispersal of colored and ethnic neighborhoods, about urban development, redevelopment, and affordable housing, and also changed the way we think about poverty and work and a people's history. It is significant to me that this is the California Book Award and that it truly honors the history and legacy of the people of California, in particular San Francisco and its extended East Bay, that it honors our work, our struggles for civil rights and social justice. For my family and friends, and for a small but mighty and idealistic independent press named Coffee House Press, for my fellow writers, colleagues, my teachers, and my students, and for the legacy of those activists and people of conscience remembered here, please know my gratitude for this recognition and wonderful honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. And thank all of you so much for celebrating some of the great literary works of 2010 with us tonight and helping commemorate our 80th annual California Book Awards. Thank you as well to Richard and the Bank of the West for their generous support, and also to Dr. Martha Cox. And I would like to also thank all of the authors here tonight for allowing me to crudely summarize their work in my introductions. A quick reminder, each of the winning books is for sale outside, and during the dessert reception, the authors will be signing books in the library. I'm not sure where that is, but it's in the reception area. Beautiful. I'm Jack Boulware, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Oh.